Hello, Will.
Hey, Rohan. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Very well. I'm pretty excited about our topic today because it's something which I've been, I'm no expert, but it's something that I've been reading about a fair bit myself.
Yeah.
For the listeners who obviously aren't privy to our conversations outside of these podcasts, the idea today is to sort of, well, the topic is going to be the current doping issues in Olympic sports, in particular, what's happened with a Russian skater, which has been sort of discussed quite a lot over the last week or so. And I think our approach is to sort of treat it a bit like a interviews topic, right? Because, of course, Oxford and Cambridge, they can pick any range of things that they want to talk with a student about. And of course, often it might be, for certain subjects in particular, it could be sort of an ethical discussion. It could be a discussion about, you know, whether or not, to what extent there should be doping rules at all those kind of things. So I guess we'll just sort of unpack it and see where we end up, right?
Yeah, sounds very reasonable. And I guess, you know, the whole point, I guess, is of these is it's essentially a deep dive into a topic that could easily get discussed at an Oxbridge, Oxbridge College over dinner or in a supervision group.
Sure. Yeah.
I've kind of blissfully, I suppose, been unaware of this saga. So just for me and the listeners at home, like, give me a quick summary of
the
topic.
So there's a 15-year-old skater in the Russian Olympic team, although it's not actually the Russian Olympic team. It's the Russian Olympic Committee team, because a few years ago, surprise, surprise, they were done for doping. And so it's happened again. But so she was part of the figure skating team. They had won a medal. I can't remember if it was I think it might have been gold, but it might have been silver as well. I can't remember exactly what nature of medal, but they'd sort of won a medal in their skating competition. And before they had the medal ceremony, it arose that a drug which was banned on the World Doping Agency's list was sort of, you know, in her system. And they sort of suspended the ceremony until they could work out exactly what had happened. And you might think, well, that's sort of pretty open and shut. She's been doping, so she doesn't get the medal. And presumably it just goes to whoever was next best. But there are a couple things. The main thing is that she wasn't actually caught doping at these Olympics. The drug test that they took was from December in sort of a different skating championship. And so I think the Russian Olympic Committee argument is, well, you know, she wasn't, you know, this test isn't even to do with these Olympics. So, you know, should that really be considered? And we can talk about that a bit. I mean, I'm sure the argument is also, she wasn't doping or whatever it is. I think it's the drug is apparently a drug which is used to treat angina.
There's a lot of them.
I wasn't expecting you to be able to pick it out, but apparently has sort of performance enhancing properties as well. That is an interesting thing that so many ordinary sort of over the counter drugs are performance enhancing in some way. Like, I think a couple of years ago or not too long ago, I think ibuprofen was on their list of drugs that sports people couldn't take. Do you know what it might be about ibuprofen that was?
Ibuprofen? Not really. I mean, it reduces inflammation, but it's nothing obvious that comes to mind.
I know
they also appear quite harsh to penalize an athlete who would legitimately take ibuprofen to recover from, you know,
from all those sporting injuries from doing all the sports all the time.
Yeah.
So I know that since then ibuprofen has changed sort of their recipe so that it's no longer. So it might just be that I don't really know the time frame for this. It could have been in the last 5 years. It could have been in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's interesting to me that somehow so many drugs are performance enhancing. But I suppose, you know, at the end of the day, they're doing something to do with your physiology, and it's likely that that's going to have some kind of impact on how well you can do a sport, right?
Yeah. I'm just looking at this now, and it looks like it's a drug called trimetazidine. I can't even say it now. but, yeah, it's essentially an anti-anginal drug, trimetazidine. And, yeah, it's found, you know, it's marketed as lots of, I mean, it looks like it's available in most major world first world countries.
Mm.
It's put on the banned list in 2014. Suppose most of these anti-anginals, what they do is they kind of, you know, either make your arteries slightly wider, or they reduce the oxygen requirements by of muscles, or the demand on the heart. Okay. So to a certain extent, like, it makes sense why most medication would be performance enhancing to a certain extent.
Mm. Well, I suppose one of the first things to discuss might be where should, you know, we can come on to whether or not a line should be drawn, but where should the line be drawn? If we are going to say certain drugs athletes shouldn't be using, what there you gave the example of widening arteries. Mm. Is it sort of something cardiovascular, which is going to mean that it should be taken off or be put on this list, do you think?
I mean, it would just be cardiovascular. And also, even just going into cardiovascular, eating salt will cause, like, differences in cardiovascular output.
Yeah.
Certain diets in the world have different levels of salt. So, you know, it's a very slippery slope, isn't it? I mean, and not just like diet. I mean, obviously, it depends on essentially what you define as a drug, because... Mm. One thing is synthetic, but it wouldn't be particularly difficult to, you know, for instance, iodine is shown to improve cognition, which is, you know, and it kind of, it's one of the reasons actually proposed why the Japanese and the kind of Chinese evolved is probably the wrong word, but kind of got ahead of like their Western counterparts. You know, for instance, they were said to be like, technological advances, and it was just because they were fishing a lot more in those areas which has higher iodine content in it.
Okay.
So, I mean, I don't know whether there's like significant merit in that, but the point is diets are different, therefore does food count as a drug?
Yeah.
And if it doesn't, like, does the location impact? So just staying on the cardiovascular theme, you've probably heard of this. If you train at altitude, you're number of red blood cells in your, the total number of red blood cells and the percentage of your blood that consists of red blood cells called hematocrit increases. So often what athletes do is they go to mountains and hills to kind of train for like several weeks, and then they come back and they've essentially got much higher ability to carry oxygen than they did.
But even more than that, they train very high and then they take out their blood.
Mm.
And then when it gets time to, you know, to play, they pop into the fridge, take that back, and then inject it in themselves. And I don't know, I'm not sure if that's sort of what the rules are around that, but, you know, you're right. That is a way to sort of artificially, you know, increase your output, mm-hmm. basically. So
I think, you know, for that, there are rules in place. So, for instance, I think you essentially have to have baseline levels of tests done to you if you're thinking of applying to the Olympics. And then if there's a significant change in certain biochemical markers, then it raises question flags. And one of the things they do measure is hematocrit.
Okay.
But they do allow for a little bit of percent, because they almost expect people to kind of go, I think if your blood volume is significantly higher, or you've got more red blood cells, and that's probably a big thing. But you know, yeah, it's a fair point, right? The other thing, I guess, Will, is technology often lags behind with drugs. So I kind of understand why they tested this girl after the Olympics. I mean, in fact, there's a, I don't know if you've seen, but there's like an adjusted medals table. So obviously, like, everyone celebrates at like you know, when the last Olympics happened, we all celebrated, said, hooray, happy days.
Yeah.
This country won. But actually, I think it's for the next up to 8 years, they carry on testing these athletes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then, because essentially the technology to test the
doping substances
hasn't actually been invented when the doping substances are in. So, I mean, I've got some numbers for you, which you might be interested in here. But there isn't actually a huge difference in the genders. So, you know, slightly male heavy, 54 versus 46% for women.
In terms of that are caught doping?
That are caught doping. But in the last, since the Olympics restarted in the 70s, 80s, I think, they stripped 150 medals for doping. Of which, no surprises here, the biggest culprit is athletics.
Yeah. Is there a country that's a big culprit, or does it not stand out?
I thought you might ask that. Well, as you'd expect, the number one country is Russia.
Russians, okay.
with 12 gold medals, 20 silver, and 11 bronze.
Yeah.
For a total of 43 out of the 150.
Yeah, wow.
And actually, the next three are kind of in that region, I suppose. Ukraine, Belarus, Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And then the US is next from there. But actually, the interesting thing is the drop from Russia at number one at 43 to number two, Ukraine, is at 11. So there's a huge discrepancy.
Yeah. But I suppose, because if they're doing this testing retrospectively, obviously our understanding of how drugs interact with the body develops as well, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a feasible world in which an athlete is taking some kind of medicine for something, and only long after they've actually competed and everything do we realize, oh, actually this also has an effect on XYZ.
And it's completely incidental that
and that would be grounds to strip them of their medal.
And I think that's actually a defense that a lot of these athletes use.
There was a
really, really like crazy good spinner, a cricket ball spinner called Shane Warne.
I do know Shane Warne.
And he was accused, and he was actually banned for a period of time as well.
Okay.
And that was essentially his argument, that he said when he was taking these drugs, you had no idea that it was banned. And then, you know, I remember that reading the article, because I was like, well, how do they test these things? Because, you know, with blood tests, it's fairly simple. Mm. I was like, you know, it'd be so easy to fake a urine sample, for instance. But it is literally what you imagine, which is someone follows you, you drop your trousers, and then they observe you, and then to make sure the sample's accurate.
Golly. Yeah.
So they do take it pretty seriously.
Yeah. But it's obviously, that's quite a stress for athletes to have, right? You'd almost if you were unwell or needed medication, you'd almost be hesitant to take medication for the fear that you might lose your medals, which is, of course, really bad for public health.
Yeah, I remember there was this one article by, I can't remember who it was now. It was one of the gold medalists of the GB team in 2012.
Okay.
And she was saying that when she was speaking to some of her US counterparts, they would often tell us stories of their coaches like saying, take this this special formulation, and kind of like hinting that they had like things in it, and just hinting. And obviously, I mean, as far as I know, I mean, unless they're one of these eight people that were stripped of their medals from the US, it was actually the coaches were using the placebo effect to actually make the athletes think.
Oh, wow.
So there's a huge amount of psychology kind of involved here. But as an athlete, I mean, I'd be terrified that God would give me a drug and going to get me banned, right? So, like, there must be such mind games, like, because you obviously want to trust them.
Yeah, that's amazing. There's obviously this sort of arms race, right, of the doping agency developing technology to catch it and things like that, and the coaches and the sports people sort of, you know, trying to work their way around it. But it's so interesting that they went with a placebo to sort of trick someone into thinking their performance was being enhanced. That's great.
Yeah. It's just almost kind of flipping it on its head, isn't it?
So,
we don't need the doping. We just need to think them. We just need them to think they're being doped.
But I suppose, you know, ultimately, it's sort of, you could sort of see let's say the 100 meters as an experiment.
Sure.
Right? You have your 8-10 variables at the starting line, and you know you're wanting to see which is the fastest of your variables. And I suppose from the doping agency, the whole point of what they do is control, right? They're trying to control the extraneous factors by sort of controlling how much you're sort of expanding yourself pharmacologically. There are so many things about sports that isn't controlled.
Yeah.
So you sort of wonder, well, why bother there? If, because, you know, you think sort of having slightly higher oxygen uptake is going to have a difference to your performance. Well, so is if you've got a, you know, sports budget in your country of millions of pounds and you can pay for, you know, all these nice sort of machinery and equipment in comparison to the athletes who, you know, when they're not an athlete, they're also a fisherman because they have to work as well.
Yeah, essentially. And I suppose, where does it end, right? Because, I mean, I assume this has already happened, but we must start getting athletes who have genetic dispositions, which would normally render them ineligible. Like, for instance, someone with a Klinefelter syndrome, who's technically, you know, or a Turner syndrome, who's technically a woman, or you know, someone who's got the Y chromosome, XXY, for instance. Like, which category do you enter them into?
Well, that is in of itself a whole, you know, very big discussion these days, right? And I think we said we would try and steer clear of it in case we caused any unmeant offense. But you're right. You know, that is something which does it's a thing. It's a variable which you can't and shouldn't control.
Yeah.
But it leaves you with sort of, well, how do we do this? You know, the point is to try and be as fair as possible in sport.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, you're still going to have someone who wins and someone who loses.
Yeah.
And you can't sort of have them on level pegging at the start, because that's not the point. The point is one of you will have trained harder, worked harder than the other.
I guess it's not just, I suppose the problem is it's not just assessing effort. It's assessing effort with a backdrop of gifted genetics.
Yeah.
/ acquired, you know, and adaptation. So like Usain Bolt, one of the reasons he was like, I mean, I'm sure he trained like mad for his, you know, like medals, but he also had like completely flat feet, which is just very unnatural.
Okay.
So he didn't have any feet, essentially he didn't have any arches in his feet.
Okay.
Which allowed him to put a huge amount of force through his foot compared to others. So this is the reason he was able to kind of generate extra lift. That probably contributed a huge amount.
But it's interesting you say that, because, of course, having flat feet was a reason not to be recruited into the World Wars, right? I think if your feet were flat, they wouldn't take you on. I imagine it's... I'd have to research that. But that's what I'd heard. And I might be something to do with being able to go on long marches.
Yeah, it might but of just course, be like the boot that they gave out.
But they've missed a trick. They could have had these amazingly fast shock troopers with their flat feet.
We could have defended against Blitzkrieg much easier.
So I guess, you know, you said that actually there's lots of differences, sort of particularly genetic differences between all these people. You know, I guess the argument is, what more does the extra doping difference make? But I suppose the counter argument is, you know, there are all these differences, but at least this is something that we can sort of control. Not everyone has equal access to these kind of the kind of facilities to dope. And I suppose there's also an argument of there's sort of a sense of purity around sport, you know, in terms of like just sort of doping is made to seem like quite a dirty act, and sort of the sportsman or sportswoman is meant to be this sort of angelic creature who's sort of righteous and incredibly fast. But you know, just because people want sport to be like that, does it mean that it needs to be? And is anything gained by it, really?
Yeah. I suppose it's a symbolism. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day, which is, wouldn't it be great if we had an Olympics where essentially there were no rules? So it's 100 meters, but we don't care what drugs you've taken. We just want to see what's the absolute limit. Because, you know, it's nice to say, yes, Usain Bolt did it very cleanly and did it fairly, but he had a lot of resources at his disposal. He had a lot of preparation.
Yeah, definitely.
And he didn't have a normal life, right? And most of us won't have anywhere near that type of life or that dedication, resources, biology. Wouldn't it be great to see what someone could do with, you know, completely toast up to see what someone could achieve?
So it's interesting. So our guest last week, listeners, Amber, her father wants exactly that. He's very keen on there being a non-doping Olympics and a pro-doping Olympics. But because I suppose banning doping is kind of banning progress or limiting progress. You know, for years we've been getting on in terms of sporting side of things, we've been getting faster and faster and faster. You know, first it was difficult to run a mile in 4 minutes, and then it got quicker and quicker and quicker. And you know, doubtless that's because coaching has improved, that's because training has improved, that's because equipment has improved. But there's going to become a point where you know you can only spend so many hours in a day training, and you can only, you know, your shirt can only be so streamlined. There's going to become a point where actually the next step in progress is pharmacological.
Yeah, so it's almost a law of diminishing returns after a certain point, I suppose.
Yeah. But I mean, so you said that you think you would want that. You'd want a tournament where people can do that. But if you do, would anyone bother with the other? Would anyone bother with the non-doping?
Yeah, interesting point, isn't it? I suppose it just depends on what it represents, because you're almost having to give up. Does doping... essentially, is doping viewed as an easy way? Because to a certain extent, I suppose it is cheating, right? Like by definition, it's cheating. But those guys have still had to work.
Yeah, they're not just being sat on the couch all day and suddenly...
Yeah, I couldn't just take this anti-anginal drug and go in and become an ice skater, right? Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, side effect, might become an Olympic sprinter. Yeah.
Like, in that case, we should be giving these to everyone. The NHS would have a lot less patients.
Yeah. What a solution.
So suppose, like, there's the argument that essentially if we were giving these drugs to people if you're normalizing performance with these drugs, then you'd increase uptake and increase reliance to a certain extent. Whereas the Olympics show what can be done, you know, in air quotes, naturally.
But again, I mean, what is naturally, you know, in air quotes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So one thing I also wanted to ask you, which is sort of less, I guess we talked a bit about sort of how, you know, drugs are used, how they're sort of spotted and why or if they should bother with any of that. But obviously we've got a situation at the moment where they do, you know, that there is a big, the doping agency seems like really involved. Obviously you were saying that they spend years and years testing people after the fact. Should it make any difference for this individual girl? And I think one of the things which is also makes it pretty, which has captured people's interest, is she's only 15. You know, she's really, really young. And obviously, you know, to be 15 in at an Olympics is pretty impressive, even if you do have angina and you're trying to treat it. But should the fact that obviously there was this huge doping scandal 3 years ago for the Russians, should that have any impact on how this case is seen, or should it be seen sort of in isolation? What should it have any impact on the sort of the repercussions, do you think?
I suppose it would depend on if it was linked, right? Like it's a bit unfair to penalize. I mean, well, it's literally illegal to penalize someone based on the crimes of someone else.
It is, yeah.
As I'm sure you've told me on many occasions. you know, just because someone committed, I mean, it's not actually a crime, I suppose. It's a civil, I wouldn't say offense. It's just dishonorable to do this. And just because she's from that region, does that mean she should be tried in the same way?
And I suppose the other thing is, you know, when the Russian doping scandal was happening, she was like 10 years old. So she
she was probably training in an ice rink since she was about 5. So
yeah, that is true.
But you know, are other people involved? Like, is it just
The coaches must have been involved, right? Or perhaps they. I suppose if the Russians say it was just ignorance, we didn't know. That seems unlikely, given how if they should be super on edge, right? If you were a Russian coach and you knew one of your top performers was taking medication, you would be bloody careful to make sure that it wasn't banned, right?
Well, I mean, just looking at the articles, it looks like she's claiming that there was some contamination with her granddad's medication.
Ah.
Because it would be very odd for a Olympic level athlete to be on anti-angina medications.
That's an interesting line.
I don't quite remember an instance where my grandparents' medications would have ended up in me, but
yeah. I don't know. I feel like they could have done better than that.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, I think, yeah, it's definitely a gray area, isn't it? Like, how do you prevent it from happening? Because, like, it seems like the policy is we need to prevent this at all costs.
Yeah.
And the approach is just to come down extremely hard and discourage it.
Although you say they come down very hard, and yet, obviously, the Russians have, as you said, they've had more doping incidences than anyone else. They had this huge scandal, and yet very little actually happened. They're not allowed to wave their flag at the Olympics. And obviously that's a shame, because people will be patriotic and will want to represent their country, but they're still, you know, and they're now the Russian Olympic Committee rather than Russia, but you know, they're still all competing. I don't think medals were taken back, or way more specifically to that scandal, or at least, you know, not as many as it felt like the doping was prevalent across the team. So do you think there should be, well, I suppose if you think that the doping doesn't matter too much, then you might not. But if it is going to matter, what should the repercussion be?
The repercussion for the skater, or just generally?
Generally, because you know, I think there's
if it's an institutional or a nationwide in a looser sense, a small community representing the nation.
Well, why not both? What should happen if it's just one individual, and what should happen if it's a group?
I suppose if we accept the stance that doping is bad and encourages, you know, irresponsible, dishonorable behavior, then and you know, the more I say it, the more ridiculous it sounds. Like, you know, listeners, if you do have comments, and please do correct us. But I'm a big cricket fan, so would I care if my heroes on the cricket field were taking drugs? I'd like to say yeah, I would, but actually I'd be quite interested to see what they could achieve if they weren't, if they were taking drugs.
Yeah, imagine how many sixes they'd be whacking. It'd be a great game, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. Yeah, that'd be like the peak of human performance.
but I suppose you might be more irritated, not if your heroes were doing it, but if the other team were doing it and that meant that they won.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting about like war, right? Like, because that's when we're pushed to our limits.
Yeah.
And obviously drugs are used in war frequently. And people don't seem to have as big an objection. Like if we kind of say our soldiers are being supplied with this secret drug that's going to make them super strong and heal quicker, everyone would be like, yeah, do it. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I suppose the stakes are higher. But, you know, you're right. In other scenarios, we're all for improving performance.
Yeah.
It's just in sport where we don't like that as much.
Yeah. When I was at uni, I had a few kind of distant friends/friends of friends who were taking performance enhancing drugs for exams.
Yeah.
And, you know, as far as I know, we don't test students before they walk into examination halls.
Yeah.
But those guys, I mean, one of them was working about 18 hours a day and he just didn't need sleep. So I suppose that's something else to discuss at another point. So we should probably...
Yeah, I think we'll wrap it up for today, but that is a really interesting point. And yeah, definitely something to talk about and, you know, probably very relevant. I imagine, you know, particularly at a place like Oxford or Cambridge, the tendency to need to rely on something like that might be higher than, you know, than in most places. But yeah, why don't we leave it there for the performance enhancing drugs for today? What have you got to... What's your fact today?
Well, I hope I've not said this already, but my fact for the week is that sharks are older than trees.
Okay. Like evolutionarily?
Yeah. So sharks existed before trees existed.
Wow. If presumably there were things, were there, I always imagine sort of plants having been around before animals.
Yeah.
Now, that's probably, I don't think that's necessarily right, but that's just sort of how I see it. Maybe it's because I have a Christian upbringing.
I used to think that too. So yeah, sharks are around half a million years or so now.
That's pretty long.
And they've basically not changed, which I think I find that probably one of the most terrifying thoughts there is, which is evolution just said, I'm finished. I don't have anything else to improve you.
Yeah. Mwah. Finito.
Yeah. On to the next one.
It is. I actually have a theory about evolution that I'll tell you about another time. It's not the theory of evolution.
Okay.
Did someone beat me to that? But yeah, that's nuts. So there were all these sharks swimming around. But I guess there must have been like shrubs and things back then.
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got. So mine is. My fact is Olympics themed. Rarely do I make it themed, but I have done today. And that is that there are two people that have gotten gold medals at Summer Olympics and at Winter Olympics.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty impressive. Now, one of them was in the same thing. So it's a chap called Gillis Grafström. That might have been mispronounced. He's a Swedish dude. But I think... He was competing in like the 1920s and he was a skater. So I think they had skating in the Summer Olympics as well.
Okay.
So that one I sort of see as a half. He got medals in both because he only really did one event. But there's another, the other chap, Eddie Egan, he got a gold medal in boxing and then 12 years later got a gold medal in the bobsleigh.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That is phenomenal.
What a career change.
What an accomplishment, huh?
Well, I mean, he was actually just a full-time lawyer as well. So he was just he was a lawyer.
That guy has won at life, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's done pretty well. And there's one other interesting thing about Eddie Egan. Because, of course, getting a gold medal at the Summer Olympics wasn't enough. Getting a gold medal at the Winter Olympics wasn't enough. He studied at... I think it was Harvard, and he also went to Oxford. All that wasn't enough for him. He also, this is just so strange, he broke the record. He set a new world record for the fastest circumnavigation of the globe using commercial airlines.
Oh, probably it'd be like, actually, I don't know what it'd be. What was it? Do you know what it was?
As in the route itself. I don't know the route.
And the duration, I guess. I mean, what would it be like?
So he travelled 20,500 miles.
50 hours, roughly? 48?
All I know is that it beat the previous record by 20 hours and 15 minutes.
Wow, that's a huge amount to knock off.
That's a huge, you know, it's not like those deadlifting records where it's just up by a couple of kilos each time. That is an enormous thing.
Wow. Man, I really want to meet this guy now.
Well, I think he might be dead, but but he's, you know, what a fantastic bucket list. What a fantastic set of achievements to have crossed off. Your gold medals, your Harvard, your Oxford, and your commercial circumnavigation. Yeah. Brilliant.
If only you'd gone to Cambridge, I would have...
Yeah, silly man. He made poor decisions.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks, Will.
I'll see you next week.
Cheers, bye.